call to order this hearing of the Minnesota Senate Taxes Committee, Tuesday, March 12th, 8:35 a.m. First order of business is adoption of the minutes. Are there any corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, the minutes stand approved as presented. The first item on our agenda then, or the second, is a presentation by the Department of Administration and the U of M extension on the provisions in the historic tax credit that we passed in 2023. And this is just a report. We welcome you to the committee to present it, and the slides that you'll be using are in the members' packets. What about the report itself?
This was what they sent us. This was what they sent us.
Isn't there an actual report, not just slides?
We did email the actual report, I believe, yesterday.
We don't.
I didn't get the copies.
We didn't get those
okay.
hard copies, but we will, members, get the hard copies, and they'll be in your packets tomorrow, and we apologize. You may begin.
Great. Thank you. Good morning, Chair Rust and members of the committee. I'm Amy Spong. I'm the Deputy State Historic Preservation Officer with the Department of Administration. And I thank you for allowing us to come this morning and talk about our latest findings with the State Historic Tax Credit analysis.
And good morning. My name is Bridget Tuck. I'm the Senior Economic Impact Analyst with University of Minnesota Extension. In my job, I get to work with communities across the state, really talking about what's going on with their economies and looking at how change might impact their communities. I've been in my position for about 15 years, and the original legislation for the historic tax credit had written in to analyze the economic impact, and I have been doing that since the inception of the credit.
Are you able to see the slides on the screen? Okay, great. Great. So just as a couple reminders, the federal historic tax credit has been around since 1976. It was made permanent in 1986, and there were some modifications of the federal credit during the tax reform. It's a 20% credit on qualifying rehab expenditures to rehabilitate buildings that are either determined eligible for or listed on the National Register of Historic Places. And the Minnesota State Historic Tax Credit was signed into law in 2010. It was the 31st state to get a State Historic Tax Credit, and there are now 39 states that have State Historic Tax Credit programs. So the State Historic Tax Credit does mirror the federal credit. It allows for an additional 20% credit when a project qualifies for the federal credit. And in addition to the requirements that are listed on the slide, the owner must apply to the Minnesota SHPO before construction work begins. So the National Park Service administers the federal tax program in partnership with state historic preservation offices across the country, and then the Minnesota SHPO partners with the Department of Revenue to administer the state historic tax credit. And as Chair Russ mentioned, the state credit program did sunset during state fiscal year 2023. And as a result, most of those projects in the planning stages were put on hold, despite owners still having access to the federal historic tax credit program. The state credit was then reauthorized during the 2023 legislative session. Given that no new state applications were received during the sunset period, the Preservation Office and the U of M Extension chose to highlight the historic schools that have been adaptively reused since the state's program was adopted. So the latest report shows other communities what is possible with their historic schools and the approaches used by each of those communities.
So in the analysis, I looked at 7 historic school buildings that had been approved for the tax credit. 6 of those projects had proceeded far enough that we had figures to do the analysis. I found that those 6 projects generated $180 million of economic activity and supported 798 jobs. This year's report highlights community and developer perspectives and approaches to the historic reuse of school properties. 6 of the 7 buildings were repurposed for housing, which is one of the most common topics I hear about when I'm talking to communities, workforce developers, economic developers. Housing is an issue across all of Minnesota. Developers used a variety of approaches. Some of the projects were purely financed with private financing. Some of them were much more public-private partnerships to get those projects completed. And we find that the historic tax credit does leverage private investment. For every dollar of state tax credit invested, there's $11.70 of economic activity that's generated in the state of Minnesota. That includes the private investment, it also includes the construction activity, and then it includes economic activity at businesses that supply the construction companies and its workers. What really strikes me every time I look at the historic tax credit is how unique and how communities are using this tax credit to fill whatever need they may have in their community. In this case, we were looking at historic buildings that are located in a community that maybe schools are tax exempt, so we're bringing a property that is historically tax exempt, putting it on the property tax, providing housing in this case, or providing community spaces, gathering spaces, supporting businesses. All of these are creative approaches that we've seen communities use and using the tax credit to get those projects done.
And just briefly, in addition to the Alexander Baker School, which is in International Falls, it was highlighted in the report. It's still under construction, so those numbers weren't yet available for the report. We have additional schools also working on projects. We have Kasson and the Sandstone School, which has been vacant for a number of years. Since July 1, 2023, when the program was reauthorized, including the retroactive language, our office has 23 new project applications submitted. Before the sunset, we averaged about 14 applications per year. And then before the state credit came about in 2010, we only averaged about 2 to 4 projects annually. So it does demonstrate the owner's needs for both the federal and state historic tax credits to make these projects work. And we're happy to field any questions.
Are there any questions or comments? I would just say I think this shows a remarkable success of the credit, and the way in which we dealt with making sure that it was continuing is to make the effective date a year earlier, retroactive, I guess, mm-hmm. retroactive, which meant it looks like there's one less year of the credit available. but it meant that those projects could be ongoing and that there was no break in the availability of the credit because of its we imposed a retroactivity on it. So, Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I just appreciate the in-depth analysis. I think it's a good model for us to have that written right into the legislation as we would look at future type of tax credits. But I'm particularly glad to hear the Kasson project. Certainly, that has been a long time coming, and I know that there's been some challenges along the way, and so it's very good to hear that it's continuing. But I just really appreciate the analysis that we were presented today, and I know throughout my district over the years we've seen remarkable success, and I would guess every member has as well.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Senator Hauschild.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for the presentation, really interesting. And I noticed that we highlighted, you know, I Falls, New Ulm, Owatonna, a lot of greater Minnesota areas. And in my, you know, I represent I Falls and some more rural communities. And obviously the economic incentive, I think, for reinvestment is a little bit lower than maybe a more urban area. I'm curious if you know what the tax credit amount is for greater Minnesota or rural towns versus more urban areas and what that breakdown might look like. Even just an estimate would be interesting for me.
Ms. Spong or whoever would like
Chair
to.
Chair Russ, Senator. You know, typically, I don't have those numbers handy, but I think typically, you know, it kind of depends on the size of the building and the project and what it's being, you know, turned into. You know, all of that is dependent on the cost of the project. So the credits are based on the qualifying rehabilitation expenditures. So so it does come down to those rehabilitation costs and you know, what those are. There are some efforts on the federal side to improve the federal credit to make it easier to access for smaller projects at $2.5 million rehab expenditures. So, you know, that's kind of playing out on the federal side to make it easier for smaller communities, maybe smaller projects, to access the federal and hopefully the state credit too.
And I'll just add to that that my observation over having
done
this. Chair Rest, I apologize. Is that rural communities are getting more creative in how they use this credit and really coming together to put together attractive projects that maybe it just takes them maybe a little bit longer to get all the players to the table and all the resources to the table, but then they're able to take advantage of the tax credit.
Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate, again, the work you're doing, and we'll make sure that the written report is distributed among the members as well. Thank you very much. The next item before us is Senate File 4389. Senator Fine. Senator Klein.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for hearing Senate File 4389. Senate File 4389 attempts to clarify three areas where taxation of nurseries or landscaping companies is confusing, and the owners and operators of those entities are unclear in statute when their items will be taxed or not. So it attempts to simplify it so that everybody knows what is taxable and what is not. The first area is shrub removal exemption. Current law exempts tree, bush, shrub, and stump removal service from sales and use taxes when they're sold to contractors and subcontractors as part of a land clearing contract, but it does not apply to land clearing products that are a remodel or improvement or expansion of an existing structure. So you can imagine that people have difficulty deciding whether something is clearing new land for a new project or adding on to an existing project. You know, the example would be across the street at the state office building that we're doing. Is that a new project or adding on to an existing project? So taxation is confusing. So this simply makes all of these items tax exempt regardless of whether they are part of a land clearing contract or not.
Senator Klein, would you point out in the bill itself the language that accomplishes your goals?
Madam Chair, I apologize. My bill jacket does not have the actual bill language with me. I can come back to the table and grab it, or I can have counsel touch on it.
Mr. Bergman will give you a copy of the bill. He doesn't have it in front of him. I'll just note from the language, which is first struck on page four. There isn't a whole lot of new there isn't a whole lot of new language here, but I think it's important for us to look at it. And I would, Senator Klein, call your attention to page four, line six, is where language is struck.
Correct, Madam Chair. You've identified the area of law that accomplishes the goal that I just described, the first of three goals of the bill.
Okay, and then there, the new language on page six, would you just review that?
Yes, and that gets to the second point that we are correcting in tax law. So you'll recall the first issue regarding land clearance made all of the items exempt from tax. This provision does the opposite. It makes all of the items that we're discussing included in tax. And this is for detachable units such as chainsaw chains and lawnmower blades. In current law, they're exempt when they're used for providing taxable service, and it's confusing when service is taxable or not. Essentially, this would make all of those items taxable. And you're correct, the language is on page six. And Madam Chair, and the third item that is clarified in tax law is for ventilation systems and irrigation systems at nurseries. And in the old days, these would be, you know, box fans and sprinklers. Nowadays, they're infrastructure parts of the actual structure. So a ventilation unit now looks more like a roof part that elevates and then drops back down, allowing hot air to escape from a nursery. And that's a ventilation unit, but has been occasionally interpreted by the department as a roof. A ventilation unit is tax exempt, a roof is not. This clarifies that these structures that raise and lower the roof are ventilation units and therefore tax exempt. Similarly, with irrigation systems, they're no longer sprinklers, they're these concrete embedded hoses in the flooring of a structure. And if you have an irrigation unit, that is tax exempt, but the department has occasionally interpreted these as floors, you know, and those would be taxable. So this clarifies that those are irrigation units and makes them tax exempt. And Madam Chair, there is a revenue estimate.
And so Senator Klein, just curious about why this is considered in a section of materials, and you know, there's 10 of them, materials consumed in agricultural production. Is that how nurseries and landscape businesses are considered as part of agricultural
Madam Chair, that's production? Correct, yes.
Okay, and those are the two the two items that are being added. And then, Senator Klein, you have a repealer. Would you explain the repealer? It's on the last page.
I can. Yeah, that the repealer, what the repealer essentially accomplishes is the second goal that I was describing about, or the first goal, sorry, land clearing services, repeals the exemption for land clearing services performed as part of an initial land clearing contract. So it's no longer necessary given the removal of all land clearing services from the definition of sale and purchase in section one.
Okay, thank you. And we see the effective date is essentially July 1 to putting these provisions in the law. Are there any questions before we proceed to testifiers' questions or comments about Senate File 4389? There are no amendments. Anyone? Senator Nelson.
Maybe not now, but at some point I'd like to have staff run through the fiscal note and understand the tax impacts. We can do that later.
As I know, there's this is the tax committee. We don't have fiscal notes. We have revenue estimates.
Madam Chair, how could I forget that?
How could you forget? Well, we'll ask Senator Klein to do that first, if you would. The revenue estimate.
Okay.
Do you have that in front of you?
Yes. So starting with the first line, tree removal services, so this is sort of the biggest tax expenditure of this, and this is that land clearing item that I mentioned at the outset. I will say that the industry is challenging this particular revenue estimate. They believe that's been sort of interpreted off of tree removal services, which are highly pricey, and this is more general land clearing, and they're going to the industry to try to contest that large revenue drop. Detachable units actually increases revenues because we are making them all taxable, no matter what purpose they are used for. And the operable roofing systems has a small cost of $110,000 in fiscal year 2027. Madam Chair, that's the revenue estimate.
Senator Klein, been informed that the effective date is of July 1st is good for sections 1, 2, and 4, and then section 3 is effective retroactively. This is on page 7, lines 6 and 7, to June 30th, 2019. Why a retroactive? Would you explain the retroactive effective date?
I can, Madam Chair. And this item came to me from a constituent business of mine, Gertens, who had done a great deal of development with nursery expansion on the assumption that these ventilation systems were going to be tax exempt, and then were surprised with a different interpretation by the department. And this would simply make their existing investments tax exempt as they expected them to be.
And Senator Klein, is it your understanding that the retroactivity is a big part of the revenue estimate in terms of the tax savings to the constituent?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And so if it was only going forward starting on July 1st, the revenue estimate likely would not be of this magnitude. Is that...
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Am I understanding that correctly?
I think it's an accurate description of the revenue estimate.
Okay, we'll hear from your testifiers now, unless you had anything further yourself, Senator Klein. No. So we have Mr. Scott Frampton. Is he here? Okay. And I would also invite Mr. Greg Krogstad forward. We'll hear from each one of them, and then there are two people on Zoom. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Frampton, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and fellow committee members. I am Scott Frampton, as Madam Chair had introduced me. I am a small business owner that provides landscape services, specializing in building and maintaining landscapes in the Twin Cities and surrounding area. We also have a small nursery production area as well. I'm here today to urge the committee to pass Senate File 4389. Clarity in the Minnesota sales and use tax related to landscape, irrigation, and greenhouse is very important to our small business members. The vast majority of our businesses are small business with limited use of access to full-time accountants and bookkeepers or sophisticated knowledge of accounting software and sales tax law. Our businesses work outdoors on properties throughout the Twin Cities and spend a small percentage of their time performing office and administrative work in order to make a living. Determining what services and equipment, materials, and labor require either use or sales tax and which are taxable and non-taxable is an exceptionally complex and time-consuming effort. The lack of simplicity and clarity has resulted in many members experiencing burdensome and time-consuming sales tax audits. One of those examples that Senator Klein talked about was the detachable units. As you can imagine, That could be a little bit confusing for a vendor. If one of us is at the vendor's place of business and we need a chainsaw chain and we need a lawnmower blade, we have to be informing them of what the purpose of that purchase is for. And then we have to hand them the ST3 tax form. And I can assure you they have no idea what we're talking about. So they simply charge us the tax on those anyway. However, the members are confused by these in the language that it's written. And often, the rule followers are afraid that they're doing something wrong. So it'd just be much simpler for all of us, the vendors and the small businesses, to just pay that tax and take it out of the language so we can all feel like we're following the rules and doing it correctly. Senator Klein also talked about the land clearing services. And again, a great example of this would be if one of you were building a swimming pool or a shed or doing an addition to your home. The only aspect probably of that build would be removing the trees and shrubs to make that happen. Every other aspect of that improvement most likely is not taxable as part of the building improvement. So as a general contractor, if you hired us to build your swimming pool, we would have to charge you the sales tax on that land clearing or the cutting of the trees. A large percent of the time, many of our members would not even be aware of that. They would forget about it or not even know that they should do it because every other aspect of that improvement is non-taxable. That's where we get caught up in the audit. So it'd be much simpler for us just to treat it all the same way. And obviously, there's a revenue piece of it. I agree with Senator Klein's estimate. The portion of this part of the business and the tree business is likely a very, very, very small percentage of the number that you're seeing in the revenue estimate. That seems to make more sense with all of the tree work that's done in the entire state of Minnesota, not for this very small thing that we're talking about.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Mr. Krogstad.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Greg Krogstad, and I am the Chief Executive Officer of Rainbow Tree Care. We're a Minnesota-based company, an employee-owned company, and we have over 250 Minnesota employees. We're also a member of the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, where I serve on the association board. I want to thank Senator Klein for being a champion for our industry and bringing this bill to the committee, which will have a positive impact on the tree and landscape businesses in Minnesota. The current tax code is confusing and it's burdensome for businesses. It requires businesses to create records on how detachable units are used. And the intent of this bill is to remove that confusion and those record-keeping challenges. Detachable units, they're used daily by our industry and by our companies. There is no way that we would take a chainsaw apart and replace a chain when going from doing a taxable versus non-taxable service. It is impossible, it's burdensome, it would require too much labor. We just don't do it. Also, our company, we pay sales tax on every purchase we make because we don't want to have confusion and we don't want to avoid the risk of having a negative impact from a state audit if that were to come. This bill also provides clarity on land clearing. And I want to make sure it was clear that the estimates state tree removal. Tree removal is part of land clearing, as if you clear land, you're going to remove trees and shrubs and whatever you need to do to prepare that site for some construction or for some capital improvement. That is not the same as tree removal. The majority of the work, well, actually all the work that we do in our business is tree removal in the sense of if we're going to take down a tree. This is your emerald ash borer infested tree in the backyard in Roseville. It's a hazardous tree leaning over a parking lot in Burnsville. This is removing a tree on it from a property that's not being cleared to prepare it for some type of infrastructure. That is the majority, by far, of what's associated with that estimate. So therefore, I believe that is incorrect. Now, when it comes to land clearing, we're asking for clarification on having land clearing services be non-taxable. The current law, it's unclear. If somebody is building an addition, maybe building a garage or installing a new driveway, it's an improvement to the property. Yet, because there's something that exists there, whether it be a shed or some construction, it falls into a taxable service under the current code. And we're asking it that land clearing in the preparation of building something on that property be non-taxable. It would clear that for our industry, it would clear it for our businesses, and they wouldn't have to be concerned about what is in and what is out when it comes to land clearing. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for these witnesses? We do have two people who are testifying on Zoom. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Mr. James Kimball, we'll start with you if you are there. Mr. Kimball?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm the corporate controller with Gerton's.
Mr. Kimball, you need to identify yourself in your own voice. Just say your name, please.
James Kimball.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I am James Kimball with Gerton's Greenhouses. I am the corporate controller with the Greenhouse Center, and we have Lou Gerton.
Hello, Madam Chair. This is Lou Gerton. I'm one of the owners and principals here at Gerton's over in Emerald Grove Heights, and we're here to just and of course answer any questions and of course support the bill. We had we thought we had this issue addressed in 2020, and it cropped up again here in 2023. We had a positive determination in 2020, a negative determination in 2023, and that's when we recognized that maybe the legislation wasn't keeping up with the evolution and the trends in the greenhouse industry, particularly in the integrated environmental control parts of the industry. And so that's why we're here. That's when we contacted Representative or Senator Klein, and I think he explained the situation reasonably clear. But again, we're here to answer any kind of questions. James Kimball has kind of been spearheading this project, this difficulty for us for the last year or so. So he's very, very close to it, understands the details of it, and I guess from there we can answer questions, outline whatever you need to know better about what these integrated environmental control systems are like. We also wrote an overview yesterday. I hope you have that packet. Everybody's had a chance maybe to read that packet. There might be some questions pertaining to that. So I guess with that, I can answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gerton. Mr. Kimball, did you have anything more to add before I ask if members have questions?
Maybe one thing, Madam Chair. So as Lou said, the current guidance and interpretations from the Minnesota Department of Revenue, we feel aren't evolving with the technology advancements in nursery and greenhouse production. We feel the advancement in design and building of the production greenhouses have a significant impact on our efficiency and productivity. But in addition, the advances have a significant environmental impact due to the reduction in energy use and the related climate controls. So basically, it has a net positive impact to the environment, and we would want to encourage that construction to continue. As Matt, Senator Klein previously stated, the old way was to blow, was positive airflow, which included fans and motors on ends of the greenhouses, whereas this is really passive and results in a significant decrease in energy usage from that standpoint. So we would basically ask that you would provide this clarification for the Minnesota Department of Revenue, because it currently is in the fact sheet, also provided in the attachment, that irrigation application equipment is considered ag equipment, exempt ag equipment. Climate control equipment is considered exempt ag equipment. And all we're stating is basically, this is new technology that serves that same function. It provides that same value. It's all in the integrated climate control and irrigation systems that we put in the greenhouses today. That is all I have, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'm sorry, did you have something further?
No, sorry. Okay.
I'm trying to understand the kind of the timeline here for the retroactivity. Is it the case, Senator Klein, or your witnesses, that prior to 2020, these activities were not deemed by the Department of Revenue as taxable, and then and so when an audit occurred in 2023, the ruling of the Department of Revenue was that these items and activities, whatever, are taxable, and so the businesses, particularly this business, was then handed a bill and said for 2021-22, this is what you owe because you didn't pay taxes, you didn't pay sales tax on this. So that's the genesis of the 2019 retroactive date. Am I understanding that correctly, Senator Klein?
Madam Chair, and if Mr. Kindle has clarification, he can certainly jump in, but that is my understanding. Girton's anticipated a construction project with the full expectation that this was tax-exempt material irrigation and ventilation systems. Later got a determination that it was not, and they had already, you know, were well into the project, so.
Understand. I wonder if Ms. Bears would come forward and she has any response to the challenge to the revenue estimate. Ms. Bears, welcome to the committee if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joanna Bears. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And Madam Chair, I cannot comment actually because this is regarding a specific taxpayer.
Okay, we will probably ask more questions about it, particularly if we include any of these provisions in the omnibus bill. Any more comments or questions for Senator Klein? Seeing none, thank you very much, Senator Klein, and Senate File 4389 is laid over. The next bill is a Department of Revenue policy and technical bill. And we are going to ask the department to present it. The authors are Rest, Klein, and Weber. Yes, and before you begin, we do now have copies of the historic tax credit report dealing with school buildings, and Mr. Berggren is handing that out.
Welcome to the committee. Once again, Ms. Bears, and we will hear the bill in whichever order, hopefully article by article, but whoever is testifying, if you'd identify them, and then they can identify themselves as they present the bill. And the there are no amendments at this point. I'll point out on your behalf that the these bills are technically mostly policy and technical, that have no revenue impact one way or the other. So who is going to begin? Ms. Bears.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joanna Bears. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. We appreciate the opportunity to present the department's policy and technical bill, and thank you, Senator Rest, Senator Weber, and Senator Klein for authoring this bill. And we also appreciate the opportunity to present today. We also want to thank your staff, partisan and nonpartisan. We appreciate the work that they do, and we appreciate their expertise and the relationship we have with them. As you may recall from Commissioner Markworth's presentation in February, when a tax bill is enacted, the department starts working on implementation. This includes updating our forms, our instructions, publishing guidance, and engaging with Minnesotans. During this time, the department or customers may notice items that need to be clarified or updated. Some of these items may seem relatively small, but they're important to ensure that our customers have the information, education, and services they need to efficiently navigate Minnesota tax obligations and opportunities. These are the items that make up our policy and technical bill. Throughout our proposal development process, we do extensive stakeholder outreach, including sharing language with folks who are impacted directly or indirectly, to ensure that they understand the clarifications and updates that we are proposing. We will continue to engage with stakeholders throughout session if questions do arise. However, we do understand that if there are questions that do arise that we're unable to resolve at this time, the item will be removed from the bill and we will pursue it at a later date. With that, I will have our first testifier, Margaret Reisdorf, who will cover Article 1.
And thank you, Ms. Bears, particularly for that last comment. And members, as we go through this, if there are provisions that any member is questioning, we also will remove that from the bill, either now or before we insert it in the omnibus bill. So welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Senate Tax Committee. I am Margaret Reisdorf. I'm a staff attorney at the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and I'll be summarizing the provisions of the individual income tax and corporate franchise tax article, Article 1. The section has 10 sections, this article. The first section amends the film production credit, and it amends the portion of the credit allowance portion to provide for a 12 consecutive month time frame. And this change had formerly listed calendar year, but the change is needed so that it's consistent with the definition portions of the film tax credit so that they're consistent.
Ms. Reisdorf, have you encountered difficulty when people have wanted to apply for this and they have a different fiscal year or a different 12-month period? Why is changing taxable year to consecutive 12 months why is that warranted?
Madam Chair, members, it's because this was changed last year in the tax bill, and so we're just updating the deed statutes and insurance premium statutes
to reflect.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment is effective retroactively to the same time the timing provision in the definition section of the credit was also changed, which was for taxable years beginning after December 31st, 2022. The next, The next change I'm going to summarize relates to the delayed business interest subtraction, and this is relevant to sections 2, 5, and 10. The statutes regarding the subtraction are amended first in section 2 to make clear that the definition of net income for flow-through entities also includes the subtraction for delayed business interest. This change is found on lines 3.8 and 3.16. This section is effective retroactively for taxable years beginning after December 31st, 2022. The second change for delayed business interest relates to section 5. This amends the related addition so that it has a, I'm sorry, the subtraction so that it has the appropriate cross-reference to the addition for federal taxable income. This section is effective retroactively for taxable years beginning after December 31st, 2019. This is when the interest, when the delayed interest addition and subtraction were first enacted. And then finally, the third change is in section 10. This amends the 2023 Minnesota law's temporary additions and subtractions to again make sure that the definition of income for flow-through entities also includes the subtraction. Section 10 is effective retroactively at the same time these changes in the Minnesota laws 2023 were also enacted. The next change also relates to section 2, but this change is on lines 3.20 to 3.22. This change amends the income definition for flow-through entities to delete obsolete allocation rule language that was changed last session. This change is effective retroactively for taxable years beginning after December 31st, 2022, consistent with that allocation rule change. The next change relates to Section 3 of the bill and relates to the Social Security subtraction. Last session, this subtraction was amended so that taxpayers could calculate their Social Security subtraction either under the simplified or the alternative method, whichever resulted in the greater subtraction. The technical changes in our bill simply update some cross-references so that they relate to the right computation. So the change on line 4.13, 4.16, and 4.19 all change the reference from paragraph C to E so that it references the appropriate calculation. And then finally, the second change also corrects the paragraph reference for the phase-out threshold for the simplified method on lines 4.26 to 4.27. These changes are retroactively effective to the enactment of the changes last session for taxable years beginning after December 31st, 2022.
That doesn't affect anybody filing a tax return.
No, exactly. This is
just to make sure that the law reflects the practice. Yep.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Exactly. Madam Chair, members, the next change relates to the fourth section and the new subtraction for qualified retirement benefits. This change provides clarifying language that qualified public pension income means public pension amounts received by a member or a survivor that are based on service for which they did not also earn Social Security benefits. This section is technical and does not, it reflects consistent interpretation and is effective day following final enactment.
Okay.
The next change relate to the new renter's credit. So section 6, 7, and 8 are all technical changes to the renter's credit. Section 6 amends the definition section to make clear that an individual is a dependent for purposes of the renter's credit when they meet the definition of dependent under the Internal Revenue Code and are also actually claimed as a dependent by the taxpayer. This change is on line 6.29. Section 7, the second change, amends the nursing home, intermediate care, and long-term care facility rent provisions to remove obsolete language that had related to the definition of household income. Last session, there was a change made so that household income is no longer relevant. We now use adjusted gross income. These items are already excluded from adjusted gross income, and therefore this language is not needed. Finally, Section 8 and the last change to the renter's credit provision clarifies that for the one claimant per household requirement for the credit, that married couples filing a joint return or filing separately may claim the credit based on the total amount of both spouses' gross rent. All of these sections, so Sections 6, 7, and 8, are effective for taxable years beginning after December 31st, 2023. And then finally, the last change is in Section 9. This section amends the Short Line Railroad Infrastructure Modernization Credit to just simply clarify the credit calculation. This amendment is effective retroactively to the same time the credit became effective for taxable years beginning after December 31st, 2022. And this concludes Article 1. Thank you.
Senator Weber, I wonder if you have reviewed the language on Section 9 on page 9 regarding the short line credit.
And is,
and is this what your understanding, was this going to be like what we had thought maybe of including in the first tax bill that we set aside? Senator Weber.
Yes, Madam Chair. This is certainly these numbers correspond with what was included in the original bill, and there's been some other elements that were included in the correction bill to, I think, comply with all the requirements. But mm-hmm. but these numbers here, this is exactly what I was expecting.
So this is not contrary to your bill?
No,
or so
Chair.
Forth. Okay, just wanted to check. Okay, thank you very much, and we'll move on to Article 2.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kenzie Gerber-Lord. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue, and today I'll be summarizing Article 2 of the bill, which covers a sales and use tax modification. There are two sections in this article, and both of them deal with marketplace provider liability relief. And we'll begin with just a very brief background before discussing these two sections. Marketplace providers are entities that operate by listing items for sale from a variety of marketplace sellers and facilitating the completion of any sales that occur. Marketplace providers are considered the retailers for all the sales that they facilitate, and as such, they are required to collect and remit sales tax on behalf of the marketplace sellers who operate under them. This proposal deals with situations when a marketplace provider may seek relief from liability for collecting an incorrect amount of tax. Section 1 of this article removes the marketplace provider liability relief language from where it currently exists in Minnesota Statutes 297A.66 Subdivision 3. And then Section 2 creates a new subdivision that deals exclusively with marketplace provider liability relief and provides clarity on the standard that applies. Specifically, to receive liability relief, a marketplace provider has to show that a marketplace seller provided them with erroneous information that prevented the marketplace provider from being able to collect the correct amount of sales tax. Both sections are effective for sales and purchases made after June 30th of 2024. And that concludes Article 2.
Section 2, how often has this issue arisen for marketplace providers that draws attention to wanting to make this clarification here? How often has the department had to deal with a provider saying, I did not get the reason why there's not a that the sales tax hasn't been sent in is because for whatever intentional, unintentional activity, the information was not included or it was in error?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't have a specific number of the amount of times it has arisen.
Just a general impression. Was it frequently or rarely?
Madam Chair, it's been a handful of times within the past few years. So okay. It's come up frequently recently.
Okay. Thank you. That's helpful that it's not kind of a wholesale thing that time after time after time, you're hearing about erroneous information, but even a handful of times should necessitate a clarification and a relief when the provider can give you data that shows or reasons that shows that the information was provided incorrectly. I'm sorry. Senator Drazkowski, have a question or comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It would be a question on lines 12.19 through 12.22. I'm wondering...
The last sentence of
yes, that the last sentence of that subdivision. Could you explain what that scenario is and what it means?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Drazkowski. So that's outlining a situation in which a marketplace seller provided information about their product that was correct information about the product, but there wasn't a verification step in place from the marketplace provider to verify that it had been allotted to the correct taxable category.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Drazkowski. Any other questions on Article 2? Then we'll proceed to Article 3. Welcome to the committee if you'd identify yourself for the record.
And good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Taxes Committee. My name is Peter Hendricks. I'm a staff attorney at the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and I will be summarizing Article 3, which starts on page 12 of the bill, related to property taxes and local government aids. Section 1 relates to Class 1B property. First, a brief background on Class 1B property. Class 1B has a lower classification rate on the first $50,000 of market value for homesteads owned by persons who are blind, permanently and totally disabled, or certain surviving spouses of veterans. Last session, qualifying low-income property was previously referred to as Class 4D property, and this was expanded to include a new class called 4D2, or owner-occupied community land trust property for certain.
Excuse me, where is that? Where is that language in the bill itself?
It is on line 13.25.
Okay, thank you very much. I see now. And say again why we need to add that. As maybe you don't know, Ms. Bears knows, I'm extremely protective of 4D property.
Madam Chair, and members, this amendment, it adds 4D2 property, so it's consistent with all other classes of property to receive the lower classification rate on the amount over the $50,000 market value.
Okay, thank you very much. It's helpful.
And this Section 1 is effective for assessment year 2025. The second section of Article 3 relates to applications for tax reductions or abatements. Last session, Minnesota Homestead Application Statute was amended to allow individual income tax identification numbers, or ITINs. Prior law only allowed homestead status if the owner had a Social Security number. As we know, not everyone qualifies for a Social Security number. The change to Article 3 would allow property owners with ITINs to also make an application to a county board for a tax reduction or abatement. And this change also provides for the ITINs, like Social Security numbers, to be private data under Minnesota Data Practices Act. And it's effective retroactive for homestead applications filed in 2023. And thereafter.
So Hennepin County Assessor had a fairly aggressive program for those homeowners who had an I-10 to apply for the homestead credit prior to January 1 of 2024. And they had, I think, 30%. There's about 1,100, and they got over 300, so over a third in just that one short month, that now those taxpayers with an I-10 will have a homestead classification going forward. Adding this here doesn't negate the outreach that the Hennepin County assessor did to those homeowners with I-10s that were effective, I don't know the effective date, but they were certainly effective to allow eligibility for by the end of 2023. This is a clarification and does not affect those applications. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, that is correct. This would treat those with I-10s equally in order to apply for a homestead or for a tax reduction or abatement.
Okay. Thank you very much. Senator Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The part on the very bottom of page 15, so this bill would add I-10s to private data on individuals in Chapter 13. Does it need to go to judiciary? Because clearly that's not that's got a judiciary and data practices component that's fairly significant, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Drazkowski. That had been pointed out to us previously, and we made an inquiry of the Judiciary Committee, and they said they did not need to see it. So we, otherwise, if they had said, yes, we want to, we certainly would refer this bill to judiciary. But Senator Ladd said no.
So, Madam Chair, I guess it's really surprising to me. That's a very significant question in our data practices behavior here as a state. It's adding a very large component to data practices protections, and certainly this committee is not discussing, other than inquiring here,
sure,
the merits of that, and it's not really in our purview. I'm very, very surprised that the committee doesn't want to see this provision.
Senator Drazkowski, I am, certainly, I don't disagree with you, but we don't send bills to committees unless they send us a notice that they need to review it formally. But I will get or request at least a formal statement from Senator Lantz that his committee did not need to see it. I mean, I know you're not questioning or saying that, but we want to make sure that with provisions like this, that every T is crossed and every I is dotted. So we'll make an additional inquiry.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure. Could you continue then?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The last is Section 3, and it relates to the timing on payments for local affordable housing aid. Last session, this was a new aid program, a local affordable housing which was funded by the new Metropolitan Sales and Use Tax. And aid is to be paid to the 7 metropolitan counties and currently 63 Tier 1 cities in the counties. This proposal restructures the payment schedule to better align with other state aid programs. It does not make any changes to how the aid is calculated or the aid amounts. Under this change, the Commissioner of Management and Budget is to certify to the Commissioner of Revenue by July 15th the amount of tax collected as of the preceding June 1st. Then on September 1, the Commissioner of Revenue will certify the aid amounts that are paid on October 1st to each city and county that is eligible. And this is effective for aid payments starting in 2024. And this concludes Section 3. Thank you.
I want to go back to the I-10 provision. in terms of this classification data. So what it is doing is just adding, I mean, the Social Security number is private data now. And so this is, just to be clear, it's just adding the I-10 because the Social Security number is required previously for property tax relief from the state. And we're just adding that other designation now from the I-10 to the same, under the same classification as private data. It's not an additional section, it's just adding these words in the private data section. I just want to understand that in my question to, in my question to Senator Lentz and the Judiciary Committee. Is that correct, Ms. Bears?
Madam Chair, that is correct. So I can explain a little bit. Last year when we made all these changes, this item was just missed to align the Social Security number with the individual identification taxpayer number. So we're just aligning it so that they get the homestead option for an abatement on a homestead as if they were to had a Social Security number.
Okay, thank you. So anything further on property taxes?
No, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. We'll move on to Article 4, the miscellaneous.
Good morning, Chair Rest, and good morning to the committee. My name is Jim Jordan. I'm also an attorney at the Department of Revenue, and I'll be summarizing the final article, Article 4, which is the miscellaneous article. It starts on page 18 of the bill. So first we'll go to Section 1, which does two things. First, it clarifies when a contested case commences before the Office of Administrative Hearing when a tax preparer challenges an order issued for improper tax return preparation practices. Second, it lengthens timelines for parties in the Office of Administrative Hearings to act in a contested case proceeding regarding a cease and desist order and/or an administrative penalty issued to a tax preparer. This section is effective for penalties assessed and orders issued after the day following final enactment.
On lines 18 and 19, would you say again why you're moving that from 10 to 30 days?
Madam Chair, I can just back up and give you a little perspective on this. So my understanding is that when the initial dates were put in, and this, you know, when somebody initiates a contested case, there's lots of back and forth before that hearing, and the dates were pretty aggressive, relatively speaking. What was found was that all the parties involved with these matters that have come up could use a little more time. So they're getting continuances. It's not a great increase in the amount of time, but just a reasonable increase.
And it's just another few weeks, couple of weeks or so.
Right, and I think it's critical to understand that there is no license to be a tax preparer. So it's not a situation where we're trying to take away someone's license where we would stop them from being a tax preparer. The remedy in these situations is just to order them to start engaging in proper practices. So there's less of a time rush in that sense. So that was another reason it made sense, I think, to those involved to extend the times.
Thank you.
So move on to Section 2 now on page 20. Section 2 removes the first of two estate informational return requirements. Currently, within approximately 3 years of a descendant's death, qualified heirs who claim the qualified farm property or qualified small business property deduction for estate tax must file two estate informational returns proving the property still qualifies for the deduction. Otherwise, the qualified heir owes a recapture tax. The first return is due between 24 and 26 months from the descendant's death, and the second return is due between 36 and 39 months from the descendant's death. This proposal removes the first return requirement since revenue determined it is unnecessary and duplicative. This amendment is effective the day following final enactment. Section 3 on page 21 eliminates the requirement that lawful gambling taxpayers create and file an annual cash count report at the end of the taxpayer's fiscal year. The cash count is not helpful to the department for compliance purposes and is no longer used by the Gambling Control Board. The cash count requirement also imposes an unnecessary time and financial burden on taxpayers. So as a result, the department proposes eliminating the cash count requirement. This amendment is effective July 1, 2024. Section 4 on page 22 corrects the insurance premium tax component of 2023 legislation that extended the state's film production tax credit. The film production credit gives film producers the opportunity to use their Minnesota film expenses to receive an assignable credit against state income tax or state insurance premium tax. While the film production tax credit was extended by the 2023 legislature for income tax owed, the legislature neglected to similarly extend the credit for insurance premium tax owed. So this amendment realigns the credit against insurance premium tax with the credit against income tax so that both continue to expire at the same time, in this case at the end of 2030. This amendment is effective the day following final enactment. Section 5, also on page 22, corrects an uncodified session law from the 2023 session. The 2023 session law provides an additional time for certain filers to amend their returns for Minnesota's federal conformity. The session law incorrectly references Chapter 289 instead of the correct reference, which is Chapter 289A. Section 5 fixes that. This is effective retroactively to when it was effective under the session law for federal purposes.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there further questions or comments about Article 4, Senator Weber, or about any of it?
Thank you.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question on overall process. You know, obviously, people within the department get together to discuss some of the issues that are brought forward. And how do those issues get brought forward? Is there a reach out to the tax preparers and or the public in general for ideas as to what type of corrections or changes might be made? And for example, I think about the bill that Senate File 4389 that we just heard from Senator Klein. If an industry has got conflicting issues within the tax law, do those get discussed, or is that always going to be necessary to have individual pieces of legislation brought forward?
Ms. Bayers?
Madam Chair, Senator Weber, that's a really good question. When we start looking at these, we have to look at you know, what items are getting a lot of questions, where are things that need to be clarified. We do get some from stakeholders. The issue with putting in the department policy and technical bill is it has to be a no-cost item. And so some of the things that come through the legislature usually has some type of cost to it, and so it gets a little bit more difficult. But when we're looking at our policy and technical, we are always, you know, talking with stakeholders. We're talking with taxpayers. You know, we talk to our folks who take our calls from taxpayers and other folks in our divisions just to see if there's things that need to be updated or clarified or changed based on conversations that they're having.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments from Ms. Bayers or any of the presenters? Seeing none, thank you very much. And Senate File 4091 will be laid over. The next bill is Senate File 2729. Mr. Chairman and members, over the years, there have been disputes that have between taxpayers and their representatives, and the department over the taxability of resident trusts. We have had this issue before us in the past, and here it is again. And we have not adopted the recommendations that you will see in the that are present in Senate File 2729. And the if you look at the bill language, it makes a distinction in Section 1 between those resident trusts that became irrevocable at before December 31st of 1995, and I maybe the witness will give us more information about why that is a dividing line. It ends up being a definition. So before 1995, or December 31st of 1995, there were definitional components that had to be met to claim a resident trust, and then and there's two sections of it, so 1 through 3 talks about what makes a resident trust, and then section then at B says what the characteristics are after December 31st, 1995, and what you have to have as characteristics to continue to be considered a resident trust. And I think if you look at the language there, the language itself is not complicated, that you have to have the books, that you have to do this or that, but all those things together has presented a challenge. And so this is an attempt to really clarify and separate those features to be able to assert definitively whether a trust is a resident trust or is not. And that is the bill. The revenue estimate that is provided by the department indicates that for 2025 there is a $9.3 million tax savings or cost, however you want to look at that. And then it is not static, it grows over time. And so it is by fiscal year 2027, the cost of tax savings has risen to $20 million, and again, the issue is on all of it. How many decisions to qualify for a resident trust are made in Minnesota with Minnesotans or by Minnesotans? And we can answer questions if you have them, or turn to the witness. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Resch. Mr. Michael Sampson, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Michael Sampson. I'm a partner at the law firm Maslin LLP in Minneapolis. And I've practiced exclusively in the area of trusts and estates and advising trustees and preparing tax returns for trusts in Minnesota. The current Minnesota system for deciding whether a trust is required to file an income tax return and pay Minnesota tax on its income is confusing at best and unworkable at worst. Mostly that's because in 2018, the Fielding case went to the Minnesota Supreme Court, and the court ruled that the current Minnesota statute, as it's on the books today, is unconstitutional as applied to that case, because the only basis in the statute for determining whether the trust was a resident of Minnesota and therefore taxable is whether the grantor, the person who created the trust, was a resident of Minnesota at the time the trust was created. The court said there were two problems with that. One was that a historical deadline of when the trust was created isn't relevant, as relevant as what's going on in the current tax year. That's problem number one. But problem number two is they said the residency of the grantor isn't enough to satisfy a constitutional nexus test to justify Minnesota taxing the trust on that basis. Since 2018, which is nearly 6 years ago, no changes have been made to the statute to address this ambiguity. The statute as it's written is unconstitutional as applied to taxpayers. And this unconstitutional statute that has got to be interpreted and applied by the Department of Revenue essentially requires every taxpayer to be a constitutional scholar to determine whether there's adequate nexus to Minnesota to require them to file a tax return. And a partner of mine says you shouldn't have to be a constitutional scholar just to file your taxes. The uncertainty here clearly benefits the Department of Revenue. And you can see from the Department of Revenue's description in the revenue estimate that it must have significant connections to Minnesota, including a connection to the trustee, the assets, the administration. That makes it a due process non-resident trust. They're determining what those factors are. They say it's including but not limited to a certain number of factors. That's simply unworkable for taxpayers. What we in this bill are attempting to do is to provide that constitutional nexus to trusts that were created after 1995 that mirrors the constitutional nexus required for trusts that were created before 1995. In other words, if the grantor was a resident of Minnesota and the trust was administered in Minnesota based on the same exact provisions, it can be taxable as a Minnesota resident. It is a Minnesota resident under the statute. And if not, it is not a Minnesota resident. The standard of administration in Minnesota was adopted in 2005. It's worked well since then. There's no reason to believe that same standard couldn't be applied to post-1995 trusts. And it would satisfy, we believe, the constitutional requirements of the Fielding and then the U.S. Supreme Court's subsequent decision in Kestner to have some nexus to the state of Minnesota to justify taxing the income of a trust. I could speak to the question of the 1995 line in the sand, if you wish.
Sure.
I was a practicing lawyer back at the time this was passed. Originally, there was a decision that large banking institutions like today U.S. Bank and Wells Fargo, in those days it was First Bank and Norwest Bank, wanted to aggregate their trust service function in Minnesota so that they could handle trusts that they manage for clients all over the country here in Minnesota, bringing jobs, growing their asset base in Minnesota. But because of the administration rule that was applied at that time, they couldn't do that because if they administered it here, it would be taxable here. And they asked for this rule to be changed so that non-Minnesota residents who created trusts that Wells Fargo or U.S. Bank or a family office or another service provider were administering here with back office support with employees here wouldn't suddenly be subject to Minnesota tax just because of their business decision to aggregate their activities here in Minnesota. So the resident, non-resident rule was created to say if the trust was created by somebody who lives in Iowa, but it's managed by U.S. Bank in its office in Minnesota, that shouldn't make it a Minnesota taxpayer. Only a trust created by a Minnesotan that's managed in Minnesota should be taxed as a Minnesota taxpayer. So that was the reason for the resident, non-resident rule. What we're saying here is to keep that policy decision that the legislature made back in 1997, but to clarify what administering a trust in Minnesota means so that we can satisfy the constitutional requirements of the Fielding and Kestner cases. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sampson. And we'll go to member question, Senator Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Sampson and Senator Rest. Mr. Sampson, so what has been happening with the Department of Revenue in the last 6 years with these questions in Minnesota? What, I mean, characterize, if you will, what that means.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Sampson.
Thank you. Senator, the Department of Revenue's position has been, if you're in doubt, file a return and we'll decide whether it's a Minnesota resident or not. There, as you see in their revenue estimate, they talk about other connections to Minnesota. They say describe the connections to Minnesota and we'll decide whether the trust is a resident or not. Allowing that much discretion to the Department of Revenue is fine if that's the policy of the state. But to make it that difficult for a taxpayer to know whether they have a filing requirement or not, simply because there is no clarity in the statute is problematic, and it makes it difficult for us to advise clients.
Senator Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Sampson. Just one maybe question for Chair Rest. This is a difficult area of law to read, and it's and if you don't read this area of law often, it's I'm still catching up here, but one question I have about this, and I see the word domiciled in here at the time of death, and I'm wondering what that, what domiciled at the time of death means. And I think about, Chair Rest, another situation that I know can occur is that you may have a resident from Wisconsin or Iowa or one of the Dakotas that is in a nursing home in Minnesota and may die there but still consider themselves a resident of the other state. How is that affected here in the bill or in current law? I don't know, and I'm Mr. Sampson's nodding his head.
Senator Rest or Mr. Sampson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Drazkowski, I certainly don't know the answer to that, but perhaps Mr. Sampson can shed some light on it.
Mr. Sampson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, thank you. Domicile is a term that the Department of Revenue has clarified in its regulations. And essentially, domicile is the place where a taxpayer has determined to remain indefinitely, to make their permanent home. Once you have established domicile, if you wish to change your domicile, you have to establish domicile somewhere else. So the Minnesota Revenue Department's position and our understanding of that is if someone's domiciled in Minnesota and they move to a nursing home in Wisconsin, but they continue to believe that Minnesota is their home and that if they could live outside of the nursing facility, they would be in Minnesota, they're still domiciled in Minnesota. They may be resident in Wisconsin, but they're domiciled in Minnesota.
Senator Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Sampson, the inverse then would also be true if they're from Iowa and they're in the nursing home in Minnesota, if they, however the department is determining their rules, believe that they're not a they're not living in Minnesota, then the department will leave them alone.
Mr. Sampson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, thank you. That is the position that we would assume the Department of Revenue would apply, that domicile of an individual is where they're domiciled, not where they're residing. So if somebody's at the Mayo Clinic when they die, receiving treatment when they die, but their domicile is in Iowa, they are domiciled in Iowa. They may be resident in Minnesota. This definition is for a resident trust. There are other definitions in this section of the statute to define a resident individual. And those rules are have two prongs, domicile and physical presence in the state. You may have heard of the 183-day rule that people talk about to be resident in Minnesota. Those rules don't apply to this definition. It's simply domicile of the grantor, whether they have that state of mind to think of themselves as permanently resident living in Minnesota indefinitely or not.
Thank you, Mr. Sampson, Mr. Chair.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question that I have is relating to the revenue note attached. It says that the estimate assumes that 10% of resident trusts would be reclassified as non-resident trusts in 2025, with an additional 5% reclassified each year after thereafter. What is the basis for that estimate, or is it just a simple or was the SWAG method used for that, to be honest about it?
Mr. Sampson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, thank you. I can't speak to the underlying motivation or analysis, but it certainly sounds to me like an estimate, based on an estimate.
Okay.
Senator Weber. Any other questions or comments from the committee? Senator Rest, final comments to your bill?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Final comments to your bill if you want.
No.
With that, Senate File 2729 will be laid over.
And Mr. Chairman, you may adjourn the committee.
The Taxes Committee is adjourned.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's very complicated.